is to finish up the handout from last time, 16B, which shows all the major glands and hormones. And I want to look at the parts of that that we didn't look at carefully. And then if you want more of them, there are plenty more over here. And then what I'm going to do is to talk in more detail about one particular part, what's called the hypothalamus anterior pituitary axis. That's this part over here. But before I do that, I want to wrap up the parts. Whoops. Okay, Sagit, I need you. Will you get it from me?
Yeah.
They've rebalanced the boards. They were too hard to push before, so what they've done is to make them heavier. But they've made them lighter, but they've overdone it. So we'll put some more chalk on it and hope it holds. Okay. Now this one I think I can do without for now. So we'll push that one up. Now, we talked a lot last time about the left half of this, but I want to talk about the right half and also about the part that's down here on your handout, the adrenal medulla and the pancreas. And to try and make it clear, I've put all the glands in boxes and the hormones without. Now, we talked about last time the fact that the hypothalamus connects differently to the anterior and posterior pituitary, which are really quite different. They grow together, but they have different sources. That the anterior pituitary is of epithelial origin and grows up from the mouth, and the posterior pituitary is really an extension of the brain. Because what it contains are the nerve endings of cells whose bodies are in the brain, in the hypothalamus, which is part of the brain. And what happens is that peptide hormones are made in the cell body, transported in vesicles down to the nerve endings, and then released into the posterior pituitary, where they're picked up by capillaries and carried through the general circulation. And the two hormones that are released this way are oxytocin and vasopressin, which are both short peptides. And they're extremely similar to each other. They are homologous, meaning that they come from a common origin. A single gene got duplicated, and the two copies diverged. But they haven't diverged all that much, and these two hormones are extremely similar. And they work in the same way, that they both use G-protein-coupled receptors to achieve their ends. Now, what do they do? I think we already mentioned oxytocin. It's involved in contractions, both of the uterus during childbirth and also of the mammary gland. In order to eject milk, you have to have oxytocin. Now, to make milk, you need prolactin, which is one of these others. But to get it out to the baby, you need oxytocin. And it works in part, at least, through IP3 and calcium, triggering contraction. Now, vasopressin, on the other hand, you notice it has two names, vasopressin and ADH. And that's because it was discovered twice. So it got named by two completely different groups of investigators who were investigating different things. It's called vasopressin because it increases blood pressure. And it's called ADH, or antidiuretic hormone, because it decreases urination. Now, the connection between these two is the water retention. It causes water retention, and therefore there's less urination, more water retained, more in your blood vessels, and therefore higher blood pressure. So we'll explain how it works when we get to the kidney. But the people who were studying kidney function named it ADH, and the people who were studying blood pressure named it vasopressin. It's the same thing. Now, what about these two other glands down here that are not part of the hypothalamus, etc.? Well, the adrenal medulla is different from everything we've talked about so far in that what connects to it and turns it on is not another hormone. That it doesn't get chemical input, it gets electrical input. Now I'm going to redraw it because the adrenal gland, like the pituitary gland, has two parts, one epithelial in origin and one nervous. And the adrenal medulla is the middle part. Medulla just means kernel. So the middle part is the adrenal medulla, and the outside is the adrenal cortex. Now, the adrenal cortex, we see, is part of the anterior pituitary cascade part, and we're going to leave that till later. The only thing worth mentioning is what turns on the adrenal cortex. You notice its stimulus is chemical. Adrenal cortex tropic hormone, or ACTH, is what turns it on. So the stimulus here is ACTH. But what's the stimulus to the medulla? It's actually a nerve connection. So we'll just draw that in. And this implies that there are two ways to get a gland to do something. It can have nervous stimulation, or it can have hormonal stimulation. Some glands get both, some get one or the other. And since this itself is nervous tissue, what it releases is a compound or compounds that are normally used by nerves as transmitters. The nervous tissue in here releases the signal molecules that are usually used to signal the next nerve or muscle, get on with it. And these are the same compound, then, can be used as a neurotransmitter, or in this case, it's considered an endocrine hormone. Now, if you release a compound, what makes it an endocrine? A gland had to make it, and it has to go into the blood. So what's secreted here goes into the blood, and it's either epinephrine or norepinephrine, also known as adrenaline and noradrenaline. Now, as a transmitter, the primary transmitter is norepinephrine, and here the hormone function, most of the material released by the adrenal medulla is epinephrine. But almost every source that releases one releases both, but more of one or the other. In this case, we get mostly epinephrine. These two are extremely closely related, and we'll go over their structure in a little bit, but I don't want to do it quite yet. Now, these are hormones, but they actually also have another name in our standard classification system. These are endocrines, secreted into the blood, go do their thing. But what released them was nervous tissue. And therefore, these, strictly speaking, are neuroendocrines because of their source. Now, we've been talking about receptors. What kind of receptors do these use? We've already talked about their receptors when we talked about how epinephrine kicks in breakdown of glycogen. And in other contexts, the receptors for these compounds are called adrenergic receptors. The name adrenaline has fallen into disuse, and epinephrine has replaced it. But unfortunately, the name of the receptors is still adrenergic receptors from the old use of adrenaline. And there are multiple adrenergic receptors, which we've talked about before and we'll talk about again, and they're usually classified as either alpha or beta. And that has to do with their preference either for norepinephrine or epinephrine. And we'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. Now, what about this other hormone, this other gland that I put in here, the pancreas? The pancreas actually is both an exocrine gland and an endocrine gland. We have not explained what exocrine glands are. We will in a minute. 10 minutes. When we get to the next big exocrine secretion, we'll talk about it. But as an endocrine gland, that is, considering what it secretes into the blood, it secretes two main hormones, glucagon and insulin. And these control the glucose levels in the blood. As I think we explained earlier, one of them raises the level and one of them reduces the level. So you have both a heater and an air conditioner to maintain an approximately constant glucose level in the blood. Now, what's also interesting here is the input. Most of these glands produce a hormone in response to another hormone or in response to nerve stimulation. Now, the pancreas does that to some extent, but it gets another input, which is perhaps the most important. And that is, it actually responds to the glucose concentration in the blood. It responds to a local condition. It's not the glucose somewhere else, but the glucose in the blood bathing the pancreas, which triggers the pancreas to do its to release insulin or glucagon. Now, what that means is some sort of sensor or detection system for glucose levels must exist in the pancreas, which in fact it does. Now, these are not by any means the only glands and hormones, but these are the major players. And what I want to do now, having talked about this side of the chart, is I want to go back and take a closer look at this side, unless there are questions so far. Yeah? So where do the nerves come from? They come largely from the sympathetic system, which is something we haven't explained yet, which we'll get to. Yeah? How does the pancreas detect glucose levels is A, not totally understood, and B, I don't want to go into it now, but it's a very interesting question, to which we will maybe get, or ask me afterwards, because there's... But I don't want to get into that right now. In many cases, the sensor for something is in one part of the body, and then it sends a message versus via either nerves or endocrines to the another part of the body. What's interesting here is that the sensor is actually in the organ itself, which will produce the hormones. That's the point that I want to make here, and we'll get back to the mechanism, I hope, later. So now I want to look at this part. And one way of doing that is to remind ourselves that there's a sort of three-stage thing here. That the hypothalamus, in all cases, releases hormones, known usually as releasing hormones or releasing factors, which affect different cells of the anterior pituitary. And those cause the anterior pituitary to produce, to stimulate, I should write it this way, to stimulate a gland. And the hormone released by the anterior pituitary is called a tropic factor, or a trophic hormone. That includes all of these. And then finally, the gland makes an actual hormone. And we actually talked about an example of this last time. We said if you're talking about the thyroid, which makes thyroid hormone, it's kicked in by thyroid stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary, which is kicked in by thyrotropin releasing hormone from the hypothalamus. That's this sequence here. So now we want to go back and look a little more closely at these various stages in this process. Now, what about these releasing hormones or releasing factors? How do they get from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary? We went over the anatomy of that last time. This is where the portal vessel comes in, that blood brings in the raw materials and other signals to the hypothalamus, then the hypothalamic neurons release the releasing factors directly into the blood. So this isn't one case where you make it and the end is it, where the synthesis site is in one gland, essentially, and the release is in another. Here, the synthesis and release is in the same gland in the hypothalamus. And then the hypothalamus releases the hormones, the releasing factors, into the portal circulation, which takes them directly to the anterior pituitary. They do not go through the whole circulation. And then in the anterior pituitary, there are multiple kinds of cells, and the appropriate cell type responds to the signal and releases its tropic hormone. Now, one thing we forgot to say here is who's running the hypothalamus. Everybody else is getting instructions from above. The hypothalamus gets all three kinds of input that we've mentioned already. That is, it gets nervous impulse input from other parts of the brain and the nervous system. It gets hormonal input from other glands feeding back on it. And it has sensors for local conditions. So it has sensors, for example, for temperature and for osmolarity, concentrations of salt. So it responds, it is in some ways a master hormone responding to multiple inputs and then essentially summing them up and releasing hormones appropriately. Now, these so-called releasing factors are generally activators. They're generally stimulators, in that the releasing hormone binds to the receptor in the anterior pituitary and causes the release of the tropic hormone. But there is at least one and probably several so-called releasing factors which are really inhibitory factors. They really prevent release of something from the anterior pituitary. So we also have to add that they're inhibitory hormones. Now, in the how do they work, what are they made out of, all of these factors are peptides except for one. They're all peptides except one, which happens to be dopamine, which is a small molecule. And all of these are water-soluble material, and they all work by G-protein-coupled receptors and cyclic... No, by G-protein-coupled receptors. I mentioned this compound, dopamine. I've mentioned epinephrine and norepinephrine. It turns out they are all related. So to get that sort of straight, let's take a look at 17A, where for reference here in the top left, we've explained how these are all related. And to do this, I need colored chalk, so I have to get my colored chalk. So all of these are related to tyrosine. So if we draw tyrosine, which is your standard amino acid, with an amino group and a carboxyl group, and a hydrogen on that alpha carbon, and then it has, for a side chain, CH2 aromatic group with a hydroxyl. So that's tyrosine. Now, dopamine is closely related. All you do in dopamine is to remove the carboxyl and substitute a hydrogen, and then you add an OH over here. And once you dot that, you've got dopamine. So scratch the carboxyl and add a hydroxyl. Now, all of these compounds, not tyrosine, but dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine, are known as catecholamines. And the reason for that is that this structure is known as catechol. But this is clearly an amine, and it's derived from catechol. So that's dopamine. Now, maybe to make it a little bit clearer, we'll get rid of the carboxyl for good, because all the catecholamines are derivatives of this. So this is dopamine. Now, how do you get norepinephrine? All you do is add a hydroxyl here and remove one hydrogen. Now, nor just means minus one methyl. So norepinephrine and epinephrine only differ by a single methyl. This is norepinephrine. Where we add the methyl is on here. So if we add a methyl there, we get epinephrine. if without the methyl, we have norepinephrine. So you see that all three of these compounds, dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine, are very similar. And they are all used both as endocrines and as transmitters, neurotransmitters. Now, they all use G-protein-coupled receptors, all the catecholamines. But the result that you get depends on what G-protein is this coupled to. So there's a collection of G-proteins, and the G-proteins can either trigger the cyclic AMP pathway or the IP3 pathway, and they can actually either inhibit or activate adenyl cyclase. So the result can be either the cyclic AMP goes up, the cyclic AMP goes down, or you trigger the IP3. So those are the possibilities. Now, when we think about receptors, we've already talked about adrenergic receptors, and they come in alpha and beta type. And then there are dopamine receptors. They're separate. Dopamine receptors are different from what are called adrenergic receptors, even though the compounds are similar. And adrenergic receptors differ in the alpha versus beta, in that the alpha type prefers norepinephrine, and the beta usually uses epi. Now, let me just say a word about this. When we talk about a receptor preferring this or that, what we mean is its binding to that hormone is strong. You always have the receptor plus the hormone and a complex. You don't get any action until the complex forms. If the receptor has a strong affinity, then it only takes a little hormone to push it to the right and get you some complex and get you some action. But if the receptor has a low affinity for hormone, then the receptor will only respond if the hormone level is very large. So you can have a receptor, both of these receptors usually bind both hormones, but they have, alpha receptors have a higher affinity for norepinephrine. So you have to really jack the epinephrine up before they'll kick in. And vice versa for beta receptors. And dopamine receptors are different. They have a high binding for dopamine, but virtually very low or none for the adrenergic transmitters. All right, so this was a diversion about the catecholamines and what dopamine is and how it fits in. But now let's come back and go back to our hypothalamic anterior pituitary axis. And now that we've talked about now the releasing or inhibiting hormones, what about the rest of it? So the next step is that the appropriate cells of the anterior pituitary, in response to signals from the hypothalamus, release what are called tropic hormones. Now, the anterior pituitary releases both what we've called tropic hormones and what I've just called other hormones. And the other hormones can be divided in what are called pseudotropic, because they are in many ways parallel to the tropic hormones, and then the rest of them. And we'll come back and talk about the pseudotropic and the rest, but first I want to talk about these tropic hormones and what they do. What makes a tropic hormone tropic is it stimulates the growth of a target gland. So ACTH triggers the adrenal cortex, stimulates the adrenal cortex, LH and FSH trigger the gonads, and TSH the thyroid. Now, there's tables in your notes that has all the names of all these hormones spelled out completely. So don't worry about that. Now, ACTH stands for adrenal cortex tropic hormone. It's also called adrenocorticotropin, just as thyroid stimulating hormone is also called thyrotropin. Now, we're not going to talk very much about LH and FSH. They are what trigger the gonads at puberty to release hormones. They regulate pregnancy, etc. They work in a similar way, but we're not going to talk about them. Now, all the tropic hormones, all of these, work through G-protein-coupled receptors and cyclic AMP. And all of these hormones, the tropic hormones, are peptides, as in fact are the pseudotropic. Now, what do the targets of the tropic hormones do? Once you stimulate the adrenal cortex, or the gonads, or the thyroid, what happens? Now, we know what the thyroid does. The thyroid releases thyroid hormone. The gonads release estrogens and androgens, respectively male and female sex hormones. And what does the adrenal cortex do? In your notes, for reference later, it's listed along with the medulla, what this list is, and it's also listed in a table. On your handout, there are two things listed here, cortisol and aldosterone. These are two of the three types of steroids, examples of one of each of the first two, that the adrenal cortex produces. It actually produces three kinds of steroids. And the third kind are sex steroids. After puberty, the adrenal cortex produces a small amount of sex steroids, so that females have a little testosterone and males have a little estrogen. And this is where it comes from. Now, what are aldosterone and cortisol? These are examples, respectively, of what is called a gluco, and again, this is written down in your table, a glucocorticoid and a mineralocorticoid. Now, the reason for these names is cortisol is primarily in charge of the stress response. But one of the ways it does that is to release glucose so that you have energy so you can respond to stress. And so it regulates the level of glucose in addition to insulin and glucagon. So that's why it's called a glucocorticoid, and other hormones that act in the same way are as well. Now, what aldosterone does is to control salt balance. So it affects the mineral levels, and that's why it's called a mineralocorticoid. So there are three kinds here, of which we've given an example of two, and the other you know. So this is what the adrenal cortex over here is releasing in response to ACTH, are these three kinds of steroids. Now, we focused first on what the anterior pituitary does. It releases these tropic hormones. And that hits the appropriate target gland. But the real point of all this is to get the hormone at the bottom. So the hormone at the bottom is either thyroid hormone, the sex steroids, or the steroids from the adrenal cortex. Now, all of these final hormones work in similar ways. The first two categories from the first two glands are all themselves steroids. Thyroid hormone acts like a steroid. It is a derivative of tyrosine, but it's quite different from the catecholamines, and it's lipid-soluble. And all three of these categories, then, work in the same way. What does a lipid-soluble hormone, what kind of receptor does it usually use? Intracellular, and what is it? It's a transcription factor. So all of these have receptors which are intracellular transcription factors. Some sit in the cytoplasm, some sit in the nucleus, but they all are ultimately transcription factors. And they all then stimulate transcription, etc. Now, maybe before we leave this, we should think about it. Where are the appropriate receptors? In the final target gland down here, which is receiving one of these hormones, where's the receptor? Is it on the surface of the cell or inside? It's going to be inside the cell. These are all lipid-soluble, so their receptors are all intracellular. But now let's go back one. What about the adrenal cortex, the gonads, and the thyroid who get the word from the tropic hormones? Where are the receptors for the tropic hormones? Well, all of these use G-protein-coupled receptors. They're all peptides, so they can't get into cells. So they have to use surface receptors. But what about the anterior pituitary? It gets the word from the hypothalamus. Where are its receptors? They have to be the same because all the releasing inhibited Hori hormones are either peptides or dopamine, which is water-soluble. So these receptors in turn, I want to draw it different, these receptors also are surface. Yeah? These are all G-protein-coupled receptors. All of that is, I think, carefully laid out in the notes. Okay. Now, I want to look for a minute, now that we've gone through this three-phase thing, before we quit, why all of this, why don't you do it in one shot? You would think the hypothalamus would just get with it and you'd end up with the final hormone. Notice that this is a huge amplification machine again. Because each time you have a little releasing hormone, that produces a lot of tropic hormone, which produces a lot of final hormone. And then that hormone triggers transcription. So you get enormous levels of amplification from this system, which may be its selective value. Now, I want to talk about the pseudotropic hormones, but before I do that, let me ask, are there questions so far? Yeah. The question is, her question is, how is dopamine different from epinephrine and norepinephrine? And the major difference is it's different enough in structure that it uses a different set of receptors. It's not lipid-soluble. It's water. All of these are water-soluble. Now, one way of dealing with pseudotropic hormones is to see why are they called that, because their action is in many ways parallel to that of the tropic hormones. So I'll make a little room over here. And the two pseudotropic hormones are growth hormone and prolactin. Now, what does growth hormone do? Growth hormone stimulates the liver, and the liver makes another hormone. The liver isn't usually thought of as an endocrine gland. It's usually just thought of as a tissue, organ. It's an organ. It's not usually thought of as an endocrine gland, but in some ways it is, because it releases to the blood growth factors, one of which is insulin-like growth factor, but growth factors. Now, growth factors are usually paracrines. They usually only act on neighboring cells. They go through the interstitial fluid. But in this particular case, the growth factor is released into the blood and acts like an endocrine. Now, growth hormone affects other tissues, and if they release growth factors, they act as paracrines. But growth hormone is known to cause the liver to release growth factors into the blood. And you notice this is very parallel to what gives with a tropic hormone. You get some organ to release something into the blood, which acts as a signal. And in recognition that growth hormone is sautotropic, it's also called somatotropin, meaning a tropic-type hormone that controls growth. Now, what about prolactin? How does it fit in here? Prolactin also stimulates something, a tissue or organ, to secrete something. It triggers breast tissue to release milk. Now, you can see what the parallel is. The parallel is the target tissue makes a secretion. But this is an exocrine gland. In no way is it endocrine. And milk doesn't go into the blood. Milk is secreted to the outside so the baby can get it. So we want to look now, is the time finally, to ask, what is really the difference between an exocrine gland and an endocrine gland? They're both derived from epithelial tissue. Now, if you look at 17B on the bottom, we've drawn out the difference. If you have a layer of epithelial cells, Dr. Heitland explained how, due to changes in the cytoskeleton, the microtubules and the microfilaments, one can in fact bend this layer in. And so that what happens in the formation of a gland is you bend the tissue in. And now, so you have to invaginate to form a gland. But now what's critical is how far this process goes. There are two possibilities. One is that the gland remains connected to the other side of the epithelium. And that's what you have here on the top, where when you get finished, it looks something like this. These are the individual cells. This is an exocrine gland. Something is secreted by the cells of this gland, such as milk, sweat, tears, digestive enzymes. And these compounds now go through the tube. This connector is called a duct. An exocrine gland is a gland with a duct. And through the duct, they go to the space on the other side of the epithelium. And this is either a lumen in the body, or it's the outside of the body. Remember, we said the pancreas is both an endocrine and an exocrine gland. The exocrine part of the pancreas makes digestive enzymes, which go through the duct into the lumen of the stomach, where they can break down the future food that you eat. The endocrine part of the pancreas releases its secretions into the blood. Now, if this is the mammary gland, the secretion, i.e. milk, goes out into the outside for the baby. So also with sweat and tears. Now, the blood is involved here because where does the gland get the raw materials to make anything? That all comes, of course, from the blood. But now, how do you get an endocrine gland? The difference with an endocrine gland is that this invagination buds off or splits from the overlying epithelium. So you're left with an overlying epithelium, which is from this part. It's like this neck splits off. And then you have the gland. It can have a lumen or space in the middle, or it can be solid. But you notice that this gland has no duct leading anywhere. So, although it's not shown in your handout, nutrients have to come from the blood, but if this gland secretes anything, where is it going to go? What it secretes is going to go back to the blood and be distributed throughout the body. And that's why this is called an endocrine gland, because the material goes directly to the blood, not through a duct somewhere. Endocrine glands are also called ductless glands. So the part of the pancreas that makes insulin is like this. The thyroid is like this. The gonads, both parts of the adrenal, etc., are endocrine glands. Okay, so having said that, prolactin is stimulating an exocrine gland, not an endocrine gland, but it's stimulating a gland, and the gland is secreting something important, and it's a nutrient instead of a signal, but it's a similar idea. So prolactin also is considered sometimes a pseudotropic hormone. Now, just as oxytocin and vasopressin are homologous in structure and function, so are growth hormone and prolactin. Again, we think a gene duplicated, the two genes diverged, and now we have two similar but not identical proteins doing different jobs. But these are both related, and they work in a similar way. They use a kind of TK-linked receptor, not a G-protein-coupled receptor. Now, there's only one bunch of hormones left that we haven't talked about, which is this one. And this is MSH, endorphins, and enkephalins. Now, I only want to talk about these very briefly. I don't want to talk about them at any length. MSH stands for melanocyte-stimulating hormone. Melanocytes are the cells which produce pigment. And so we know that MSH controls pigmentation. But it is assumed that it does other things as well, although it's not clear what exactly. Now, the other two classes, the endorphins and the enkephalins, are interesting because they are the natural opiates of the body. You may wonder, why do people have a cocaine receptor? Why do we have a protein that binds to cocaine? And these things appear to be the natural ligands of those receptors. We have signal molecules which induce pleasure, forgetting, etc., which these appear to be. They're called natural opiates. And people talk about a runner's high. It's thought to be due to production of these compounds. Now, the thing I want to say about these, I don't want to talk about what they do particularly anymore, lest you get any ideas. But what we want to talk about is where these come from. One of the amazing things is that MSH, endorphins, and enkephalins, and ACTH all come from a common precursor. There is a single gene that codes for a single protein. And that protein is cut up. And exactly how it's cut up depends on the cell type and the situation. And one of the pieces is ACTH. And the other pieces can be MSH, endorphins, or enkephalins. Now, this protein is called POMC, for short, which stands for, I'm going to say it, but I'm not going to write it because it's ridiculous. Is pro-opiocorticotropin, I think. It's pro-opiomelanocorticotropin, I think. So this protein is a precursor of all of these hormones. Now you notice this is not RNA alternate processing. This is protein alternate processing. Now, people talk about POMC, the precursor of all of these. But they also talk about pre-pro hormones. I want to say a word about that. What is this whole thing? This is a pro hormone. It is an inactive protein, and when it's cut in a particular way, it will generate an active hormone. Now, there are other pro hormones, of which perhaps the most famous is proinsulin. Proinsulin is only cut in one way, but it is cut to produce insulin. Proinsulin is inactive, and only when you cut a little bit off does it actually work. This is probably a protection against having the hormone act prematurely. It isn't until the final stages that it's really ready to roll. Now, we understand what proinsulin could be. We understand what, say, pro-ACTH could be. But what's a pre-pro hormone? What is pre-pro-insulin? It turns out simply to be pre-pro-insulin just has its signal peptide. So the pre-pro form means it has the signal peptide, it has the extra inactivating piece, and then it has the hormone. Now, it's not only hormones that are treated in this way. There are some enzymes which are also made in pre-pro form. They have a signal peptide, which allows the pro form to get into the ER and packaged in vesicles. And then you have an inactive form of the enzyme, which is not activated till the last minute. Many digestive hormones and blood clotting factors are made in a pro form. In the case of digestive enzymes, the inactive form is called a zymogen. You probably all heard of trypsin, which is an enzyme in your stomach that cuts up proteins. Trypsinogen is the inactive version, the zymogen version of trypsin. So we're bringing this up to make it clear that not only RNAs, but proteins sometimes have to be processed, and sometimes in more than one way, before they'll work. We know about removing signal peptides, but you may have to remove some more of it to get it to the actual active working form. Now, I want to go back and look at this axis and consider how it's regulated. I want to consider it in general and specifically for thyroid hormone, but first let me ask if there are any questions. Yeah?
Does that mean all the hormones on pumps are made in equal amounts?
Does this mean that all these proteins are made in equal amounts? Potentially, but depending on how this is degraded, you may cut out ACTH and just degrade the rest. So they don't have to be made in equal proportions. But this means that the capacity is there, yes. Yeah?
For the exocrine gland, why do the nutrients from the blood, if the tissue in that invaginated part is the same as the rest of it, why does it just go through that gland?
No, her question is, how do you get nutrients to these things? Every cell in the body gets nutrients from the blood. And we're just putting this in so you don't forget that. We're not saying that the blood goes directly to here or to here. We're saying that the blood, the capillaries release material into the interstitial fluid, which goes into every cell.
Why does it need to invaginate? Why can't it just be flat and still release the...
Okay, your question is why do you have to invaginate? Why couldn't individual cells here just release their things? There are cases like that. But this procedure apparently makes sense in that these group of specialized cells now make large amounts of hormone. But could you do it with just one cell at a time? You can, and sometimes you do. But many secretion-producing cells group into bunches where all of them work together. Now, probably the answer for why do it in a bunch is regulation. If these are all individual, you have to contact each one to do something. If you have a whole gland, you contact the whole thing. Yeah?
You were talking about growth factors before. I'm just curious if it's a family of factors or if one type of growth factors could be influencing, like, or can you keep growing or both keep growing?
The question is, how many growth factors are there? They're a huge collection of growth factors. I think all the ones that act as endocrines are what are called insulin-like growth factors, which are similar to insulin in structure. Again, homology. Duplicated genes, divergence, but are similar to each other. And I think they're a little bit different from the other growth factors. Yeah?
So those exocrine glands, they're getting nutrients from the blood and they're also getting their hormone signals.
Yes, all hormone signals, all endocrine hormone signals have to come through the blood. So these arrows represent not only nutrients coming in from the blood, but also hormonal signals. That's correct. Some of them do have nerve input in addition. But if they get hormonal signals, they come through the blood. Of course, if they get paracrine signals, they don't. They come directly. Yeah?
In the pathways that produces, say, epinephrine and tyrosine, are there a lot of enzymes or other enzymes structurally related? Do they come from all the displacements?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that his question is the enzymes in this pathway of making the catecholamines. I think there's one enzyme for each step, and I assume the enzymes are related, but I don't think they're alternate splicing. I think there's a gene for each one. And the question of what is their origin and whether they also are homologous is likely, but it may have happened so long ago that they've gracefully diverged. But all that's known. I just don't know off the top of my head. Yeah? Is the gallbladder an exocrine gland? Yes, I guess it is. Okay. So let's... Okay, so now let's look at the question of regulation. standard picture here. For all three branches of the tropic hormones, and to some extent for these, for this one also, you have here what look like three hormones, or three signals. 1, 2, 3. And what generally happens is the final hormone inhibits both the anterior pituitary and the hypothalamus. So it inhibits the hypothalamus from producing the releasing factor. It inhibits the anterior pituitary either by cutting down on the receptors, by down-regulating receptors for the hypothalamic hormones, or directly affecting the response to them. Now, the net result, of course, is to cut down on the amount of hormone made. And now, in some cases, only one of these is more significant than the other, and it is true that doing either one of these would probably be sufficient. But in many cases, the hormone does both. Now, I have a question. If a steroid hormone inhibits action in the anterior pituitary or the hypothalamus, where is the receptor for the steroid hormone? It has to be inside the cell. So the anterior pituitary has receptors on the outside. The ligand binding domain is extracellular. It has surface receptors for the signals from the hypothalamus. But it has to have internal receptors for the signals from the steroid hormones or thyroid hormone at the very bottom. Now, this is negative feedback in two senses. This is negative feedback in the biochemical sense that the hormone inhibits both the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary. This is negative feedback in the physiological sense in that the feedback reduces the level of hormone if it gets too high, and in fact, this system increases the level of hormone if the hormone's too low. If the hormone is too high, the signals to make more are decreased. If the hormone is too low, there is no feedback inhibition, and the signal pours in to make more hormone. A negative feedback system, in the physiological sense, is one which negates variation from the desired value. If you get too high, it pushes it down. If it gets too low, it pushes back up. And we'll talk more about that next time. Now, let's see how this works in a specific example, that is the control of the thyroid and the production of thyroid hormone. And that's blocked out on 17A. So we've written it out here in detail, where we've actually put in what the specifics are. So maybe I'll just draw it again. And this time we've put in all the receptors and everything so you can keep track that the hypothalamus releases TRH, which controls the anterior pituitary's production of TSH, which controls the thyroid's production of TH. And we didn't put this in the previous case, but the thyroid hormone now affects its target cells, which are the cells of the body. And what does it do? We didn't actually ever say. It affects the basal metabolic rate, among other things. It's needed for normal development. In the adult, however, it affects the basal metabolic rate and it affects your reflexes. Apparently, you need it to have normal reflexes. Now, what's the basal metabolic rate? That's the rate at which you burn fuel at rest. And that controls your idling speed, so to speak, and how much heat you generate when you're sitting around doing nothing. And so this controls, to some extent, body temperature is pretty much constant, but it, as we'll explain next time, but this controls your response to heat and to cold. If your basal metabolic rate is too low, it's difficult for you to generate enough heat to cope with cold. If your basal metabolic rate is too high, you have to dissipate excess heat in order to keep cool enough. Most people keep the same temperature inside, but how they do it varies a little bit. So it's very important then to have enough thyroid hormone in order to operate properly as an adult and also for normal development. In the absence of thyroid hormone, children do not develop properly and in fact are mentally retarded. Now, it turns out that this system can go awry in many ways. As we've already explained, thyroid hormone negatively inhibits. This is an old handout, so it has an arrow with a minus instead of the inhibit symbol. But maybe we'll write it in just to be clear. That normally, if you have too much thyroid hormone, that prevents synthesis of more thyroid hormone. But there are at least two ways in which this can go awry. And people get what is called goiter. Goiter is an overdeveloped thyroid gland. The thyroid gland gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And there can be two reasons for it. Now, this is one of those cases where the mechanism is really important. Because you don't know how to treat goiter unless you know what the underlying problem is. There are two parts of this. There are stimulatory parts and there are inhibitory parts. Just as with cancer cells, the thing can get out of whack because the stimulation is overdone, or it can get out of whack because of a lack of inhibition. Either one can cause overstimulus of the thyroid gland, cause it to grow too much, and cause goiter. And what you do about it depends, have you got a stuck accelerator or a broken brake? Now, one way goiter happens is what is called hypo, meaning low, thyroidism. This means low thyroid hormone. And the usual reason for this is low iodide. As we'll explain, thyroid hormone contains iodine. And in the absence of iodine, you can't make thyroid hormone. So then what? What if you have no iodine? That means you can't make thyroid hormone. So what happens if you have low thyroid hormone? No negative feedback. So you make more TRH, which stimulates the anterior pituitary. You make more TSH, which stimulates the thyroid in, so to speak, a vain attempt to make thyroid hormone, which you can't. So the thyroid hormone just gets bigger and bigger and bigger because it keeps getting stimulated even though it isn't doing anything. Because there's a failure of feedback. So there's no feedback. What do you think you do for that? Well, you can either add thyroid hormone or you can just add iodine. And this situation is much more common in parts of the world where people don't get iodide. In people who live near the ocean and eat seafood or seaweed, there's no problem. But people in the middle of the United States used to be in the so-called goiter belt and develop hypothyroid goiter. And not the garter belt, the goiter belt. And then that's why you may notice that almost all salt is iodized. The iodization of salt has, in fact, reduced the incidence of goiter and this condition to very low levels. But there's another kind of goiter which comes from sort of the opposite. And it's called Graves' disease. It comes from overstimulation instead of no feedback. And this is actually an autoimmune disease. And what happens is the receptors for TSH are jammed. Now, here is the receptor for TSH. You actually make antibodies to this receptor. And they act as agonists to the receptor. You remember we talked about before about antagonists and agonists. Agonists mimic the effect of the normal ligand. Antagonists oppose it. Now, in this case, you have a receptor. When you get a ligand, what's supposed to happen? It binds to the receptor, and it changes the conformation of the receptor. Now, what happens if you have an antagonist? So let's say an antagonist looks like this. It binds to the receptor. It prevents the normal ligand from binding, and it doesn't cause a conformational change. So it's a basically jammed the receptor but had no effect. This is like putting a broken key in the lock or chewing gum, and it can't work. But one other impossibility is that you have an agonist. You have a compound that's different but similar to the normal ligand. I should write it this way. When you add it, not only does it bind, but it causes the normal conformational change. So it mimics the normal ligand. In Graves' disease, you make antibodies to the TSH receptor. And these act as agonists. And as the result, you essentially have constant stimulation of the thyroid. Nothing turns those antibodies off. They're always there. So they stimulate the thyroid. The thyroid grows and gets bigger, which is what thyroid stimulating hormone does, and you make more and more TH. Now, why doesn't the extra TH turn everything off? The extra TH, which piles up, does turn off the production of TRH, which turns off the production of TSH. But the antibodies are coming in from the side and short-circuiting the whole system and stimulate as if there were TSH. So what do you do this time? Turns out the only thing you can do is destroy the thyroid. You feed the person radioactive iodine. Iodine goes only to the thyroid, and it destroys the thyroid. And then people take, for the rest of their lives, thyroid hormone. And this may sound bad, but it's a lot better than Graves' disease. And people can take in thyroid hormone. It works pretty well. There was a time, I remember, when I believe the vice president, the vice president's wife, and the vice president's dog all had Graves' disease. And there were a lot of theories as to what kind of conspiracy was responsible for this, but it was probably an accident. It's not the current president. Okay. So now I want to take a look at how do you actually make thyroid hormone? Where does the iodine fit in, etc.? This relates to all the kinds of cell biology things that we've been talking about up to now. And so that's why we've put this on this handout again. You want to look back at 17A. This is a classic example now of an endocrine gland. The thyroid consists of groups of cells that look like this. The thyroid looks sort of like a bunch of grapes, and this would be one grape, one follicle. And what your picture shows is just one little piece. It shows this little piece. So let's blow that up. So what you have here is a piece of the follicle. And what happens is you're going to make the hormone actually in here. But let's wait a minute. Thyroid hormone is lipid soluble, right? So if you make it, where is it going to go? Out. We can't hold it. Now, do you eat iodine every day? Do you all eat fish every day? No. Most people don't. So the system has developed so that you have a reserve of iodine ready. You actually have a reserve of thyroid hormone ready to go. So you don't have to eat iodine every day. You have to eat it every couple of months in order to keep the reserve supply of thyroid as of the form of thyroid hormone called thyroglobulin. So now what we want to look really, that's the cell biology part. Just for a minute, let's look at the protein part. How do you actually make thyroid hormone? If you look over here, you see what thyroid hormone is. Yes, it's another one of those variants of tyrosine. It has one aromatic group, an oxygen and another aromatic group, and it has iodine. This is called called T4. If one of the iodines is missing, it's called T3. You make T4, but it's modified later probably to T3, which may be active. But for the moment, we'll stick to T4. How do you make this doubleheader stacked up tyrosine derivative? The trick is you start with a protein which has a lot of tyrosines in it, which is written here. Etc. This protein is called thyroglobulin. And this protein is modified so that some of these tyrosines are turned into T4 but locked in. Now, what do I mean by that? Here's the side chain. This is modified to add two iodines. Here's another one which is modified to add two iodines. But now what happens is with the appropriate enzyme, you cut off the modified aromatic group with the iodines and stick it on top of the other one. And the result is that you get thyroglobulin, which contains T4. So here's the thyroglobulin. With the T4, etc. Now, notice if I were to cut here, if I were to cut these peptide bonds, what would I get? I would get thyroid hormone or T4. But this T4 is locked into the thyroglobulin, and so it's held until the moment when I need thyroid hormone. It's held as part of this protein, but the iodine is locked in. So I have a reserve in the form of thyroglobulin. So let's just see how this works on the cell biology level. This is our piece of follicle. Here's the lumen or the space inside the follicle. That's where thyroglobulin ends up. How does it get there? It's made on the ER. It's made on ribosomes attached to the ER, goes to the Golgi, goes to a vesicle. And then that vesicle fuses with this plasma membrane, but the plasma membrane on the inside, not facing the cell, the body, but facing the lumen. And so then that material is released, the thyroglobulin, is released into the lumen. Inside the lumen, it gets modified. First you add the iodines to a tyrosine, then you stack up the tyrosines. So now it's modified, so it has the doubles. Now, where did the iodine come from? The iodine came from your diet, went into the blood, was transported into these cells. It definitely takes energy to transport it here. There's some kind of transporter, and there's probably another one here. So there's specific transporters here. They're not present in other tissues, and as a result, iodine is concentrated only in the thyroid gland. So the iodine ends up then in the lumen where it meets the thyroglobulin, it meets the right enzymes, and we end up with modified thyroglobulin. So suppose TSH comes along, thyroid stimulating hormone. That's the signal to release thyroid hormone. What do we want to do? We want to chop out the thyroid hormone and release it. Well, the enzymes to chop it are not here. That's why it's stable. The enzymes to chop it are actually in the lysosome. So you notice, you go back here to your cell, what happens is by exocytosis, we release the thyroglobulin. Now by endocytosis, we pick up modified thyroglobulin. So now we have endocytosis, which picks up the modified thyroglobulin, and then this vesicle fuses with the lysosome. And what does a lysosome have? It has hydrolases, enzymes that break down macromolecules. So it breaks down the peptide bonds here. So most of thyroglobulin is broken to amino acids, which are reused. But some of it generates I4. So the I4 now, once it's free, can go through membranes, goes out into the blood, where it binds to a binding protein, and goes through the blood. All steroid hormones go through the blood attached to peptides of one kind or another. And therefore, this protein carries the steroid, like thyroglobulin, and a little of it can come off and enter the tissues and reach its targets. Now, thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH, is thought to stimulate both the growth of the thyroid and almost every step in this process. Now, we haven't talked about it, but there are similar feedback systems for the other parts of the hypothalamic anterior pituitary axis. We haven't gone into how those hormones are synthesized. Most of them are not as elaborate as this, but this illustrates many of the principles we've talked about before. Now, what I want to do next time is I want to talk about how hormones work to maintain homeostasis. And so to do that, we have to talk a little bit about structures. So bring back your handout. There's one piece of 17A we didn't get to, a B, I think. And we'll talk about that structure and homeostasis.